Hello, and welcome to the 11th episode of Season 3 of The Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I'm Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend, and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ray.
How's your week been, Graham?
Quite a busy one, Ray, as I think you know.
Well, yes. We've both been involved in the emerging OCCRP stories about the UK company formation agency Formations House, following the leak of information about their activities.
It's been just like the Panama Papers all over again, hasn't it?
It has, Graham. And we've been helping various journalists understand some of the intricacies and learning a lot ourselves in the process, I might add.
We have. Unfortunately, we can't talk about much of it yet. One story has come out about Macedonian car salesmen, which you've been extensively quoted in. But look out for our names as more of these stories emerges.
In the meantime, Graham, I think we promised an episode about country risk, didn't we?
Yes, we did, Ray. And when looking at financial crime risk generally, it's probably the biggest, or at least the most prominent factor behind most firms' approaches to client risk assessment, isn't it?
It is, Graham. Although it's fair to say that many firms are increasingly taking a more sophisticated approach and bringing other factors to the fore. I think gone are the days where country risk almost always determined the client risk assessment outcome.
And I think that's a fair analysis, Ray, but it does remain a crucial factor and one where firms have to start by making a fundamental choice.
You mean whether to buy in a list or do it themselves?
I mean exactly that, Ray.
Do you want to expand on the buying it in option, Graham?
I will. Now, this is where the firm buys or subscribes to a third-party country risk list from a specialist vendor. Now, this will categorise all the world's countries in terms of their financial crime risks, generally into high-risk, medium-risk and low-risk countries.
And do all the vendors pretty much agree, Graham?
Broadly, Ray, yes, they do, although there will be differences because each vendor will have its own assessment indices and weightings.
OK, unpack that for us, Graham. Indices, weightings?
Well, yeah, let's look at a typical measure that might be used as part of a vendor's assessment, and that would be Transparency International's Corruption Perceptions Index.
Yeah, OK. I imagine that's one our listeners will be familiar with. It ranks most, but not all, of the world's countries by their perceived levels of public sector corruption as determined by expert assessments and opinion surveys, to borrow Transparency International's own definition.
And that's right, Ray. Now, if you were determining the financial crime risk that any given country presented, would that be relevant to you?
Yes, it would, with reservations.
Reservations?
Well, I've got three main ones.
Go on.
Well, firstly, it's an index of perceptions and opinions, not necessarily objective fact.
Yes, and that's fair, although the perceptions aren't those of the man on the street, but they are those of experts.
Fair enough. The opinion surveys?
Well, yeah, those may be a little more widely based and, I guess, prone to bias. What are your other reservations?
Well, one is that this index measures only corruption.
Yeah, TI define corruption as, quotes, the misuse of public power for private benefit.
And that's a definition I think we can get behind, Graham. But my point is that it doesn't necessarily read across to terrorist financing or money laundering.
No, I suppose not. But on the other hand, a high level of corruption implies a need to launder money.
Yes, I'll give you that, but corruption isn't the only thing that does that, Graham.
That's a very fair point. What's your third reservation, Ray?
Well, to the extent that the CPI is predictive of financial crime, it's only predictive of the initiation stage.
So where the predicate crime is committed and money enters the system?
That's right, Graham. It doesn't reflect the propensity of countries to be enablers at the concealment or layering stage. So that right at the safer end of the CPI scale, you'll find mostly Western countries with sophisticated economies like the UK, Denmark, Sweden.
Yeah, I can see where you're going with this, right?
Now, FATF themselves call this out.
They do. They have a really good explanation on their website, which I've actually copied out for us. I think it's worth reading in full. It's quite long, but let's give it a go. Do you want to start?
Okay, I will. They begin by asking, where does money laundering occur? And go on to say the following. Quote, as money laundering is a consequence of almost all profit-generating crime, it can occur practically anywhere in the world. Generally, money launderers tend to seek out countries or sectors in which there is a low risk of detection due to weak or ineffective anti-money laundering programs. Because the objective of money laundering is to get the illegal funds back to the individual who generated them, launderers usually prefer to move the funds through stable financial systems.
And that's exactly the point you just made. Now it continues, quotes, money laundering activity may also be concentrated geographically according to the stage the laundered funds have reached. At the placement stage, for example, the funds are usually processed relatively close to the underlying activity, often, but not in every case, in the country where the funds originate, end of quote. Again, reinforcing that point.
And then the definition spreads out a bit. It says, quotes, with the layering phase, the launderer might choose an offshore financial centre, a large regional business centre, or a world banking centre. Any location that provides an adequate financial or business infrastructure. At this stage, the laundered funds may also only transit bank accounts at various locations where this can be done without leaving traces of their source or ultimate destination.
And it finishes with, to quote again, finally, at the integration phase, launderers might choose to invest laundered funds in still other locations if they were generated in unstable economies or locations offering limited investment opportunities, end quote. So in-country perceptions of corruption are just not so helpful when assessing the risks at these later stages.
I mean, I agree, but I guess the point is this is only one of several measures that the vendor is going to use to get a holistic view, right?
Well, yeah, typically, or maybe hopefully, they will use a wide range of indicators and weight each of them to come to an overall view.
And I'm assuming different vendors will have different selections of measures they consider important, right?
Yes, which is where the weighting comes in. Each indicator will be differently weighted in arriving at the total. Given that there's almost infinite variety with so many different indices and weightings that could be applied, it would be surprising if all the lists were identical.
So how do you choose between different vendors, Graham?
Well, Ray, I think you look at the various things that vendor management always looks at. Price, service, terms, the vendor's reputation, and so on.
But is that it? Wouldn't you look at how they go about their ratings and see which one you thought was best?
Well, trouble is, not all vendors will tell you their methods or the exact measures and weightings they applied. That would be rather like giving away the crown jewels when you think about it.
That's true. But thinking about this, which list you buy is probably less material than what you do once you've bought it.
In what way?
Well, Graham, the list you buy in is going to be generic. It won't reflect the unique factors of your bank and its exposures. So, for instance, if the list that I buy in shows a certain country, let's call it Ruritania.
Oh, good choice.
Thank you. If that list shows it as low risk or medium risk, but actually my bank owns a subsidiary there in Ruritania that specialises in extractive industries and it's got concentrated exposure to that high risk activity, then I might want to override the generic low or medium risk assessment and say instead that in my bank, Ruritania is a high risk country.
And that's a very good point, Ray. The bought-in lists are necessarily predicated on average assumed exposures, so you'd need to make adjustments where your mileage as a bank varies, as it were.
But that does raise a fairly fundamental question, Graham.
Yeah, why not just do it yourself in the first place?
Well, that's the one.
Well, I think there are a couple of answers to that, Ray.
Okay, go on.
Well, first there's the argument of expertise. In your example, the bank had direct experience and therefore expertise in Ruritania, to the point where they knew their country risks were not average or vanilla, and they knew why and how. Mm. Now that's unlikely to be the case for 200 or more countries, which is what you'd need to do if you do it all yourself.
Okay, so when a bank buys in a list, those ratings are a fallback. And where it has expertise, it will look at individual ratings for those countries and then either accept the list's assessment or override it in favour of its own assessment.
And that's right.
Now, you said a couple of answers, Graham.
I did. And the second is about ongoing maintenance. Do I want to employ a whole team of analysts who will continually review 200 or more countries across multiple measures and keep those country assessments current and up to date?
Or do I prefer to let the list vendor do all that for me in the background? Okay, I get it, Graham. When you buy a list, it's not a one-off purchase as much as an ongoing service.
Yeah, but bear in mind you'll still have to look at each re-rating the vendor makes through the lens of your own experience and knowledge of the country concerned.
And similarly, if your own experience or exposures for a country change your risk view, you should re-rate independently too.
Good point. And actually, there's a wider point too, which is that the regulator doesn't mind whether you do this all yourself or whether you started with a bought-in list. But they do expect you to be responsible for all those ratings and, more importantly, be able to justify them.
So it's not going to be good enough to say because our list provider said so?
No, Ray, that's never going to work.
Well, fair enough. When would you as a bank want to just do it yourself, Graham?
Well, I suppose if you were involved in most countries in the world, you could argue it would be worthwhile. Or maybe conversely, if you were exposed to just a very few of them and had policies that prohibited any exposure beyond certain countries and parameters.
I see. Most banks will fall somewhere in the middle, won't they?
Well, I would have thought so. And in practice these days, we see most banks buying in a list and then internally moderating it.
OK, good. So you've got your own moderated country risk. It divides the planet into, say, low risk, medium risk and high risk countries. Now what?
Well, first, you may find that there isn't a single high risk grouping. It would be quite common to have perhaps a small subset of that risk as ultra high risk or even prohibited countries.
So that if those countries ever crop up in your onboarding or monitoring, it raises a very big red flag and requires escalation and or exiting.
Yes. Other than that, you're good to go with the list. I think normally country risk will be only one driver. It might just contribute, say, I don't know, 30% of the overall client risk assessment.
Yeah, except that there are situations where the specific country involved will mean it's actually 100%. We said that a couple of episodes ago, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. If the country concerned is on the European Commission's high risk third country list, and we're assuming that you're in the EU as a bank, then you have to conduct EDD and effectively you're going to have to treat that client as high risk come what may.
But assuming that's not the case, Graham, can we talk about what country attaches to a client?
How do you mean?
These days we're all very international, aren't we? A client's passport may say she's British, but if she lives and works in Brazil, even if her account's in London, what country risk is applied?
Good point, Ray. I think a useful guide is to think about how that client is exposed to the risk of financial crime and consequently how is the bank involved. In your example, the client's main country risk will derive from the fact that she lives and works in Brazil.
Let's run it the other way round, Graham. Brazil has a higher country risk rating than the UK. What about a Brazilian living and working in the UK? Do we now base their country risk on the UK?
No, I don't think so. I think we still have to go with Brazil.
Because it gives the highest risk result?
Yes, I think you'd find most firms will look at the individual's residence and nationality and see which yielded the highest risk and then go with that.
Could any other countries come into play there?
Well, yes, if they have business interests or money in a third country, or let's say they even draw a pension from there, that country might come into play too if it's a higher risk country than the ones that they come from or live in.
Okay, but there are countries where the law prevents you from treating people based on their nationality, aren't there?
Yes, there are. So you might have to go by citizenship there rather than nationality.
And producing a passport isn't necessarily evidence of either. If you have dual passports or dual nationality, then both countries are relevant, aren't they?
They are, Ray. But that's individuals, of course. There are also some more wrinkles when we come to legal person clients.
Yeah, I worry about the case of an international business that might be headquartered in one country, have operations in three more, derive income from a bunch of other countries and be owned by people elsewhere entirely.
Yeah, I think you put your finger on the main issues there, Ray. Shall we just count those off one by one?
OK, so first then, countries of the headquarters and operations.
And this is likely to work on the basis of the highest risk exposure. So if they are headquartered in a low-risk country but have operations in even one high-risk country, the country risk exposure would normally be the high one.
It's like the chain that's only as strong as its weakest link.
That's right, Ray.
Now, it seems unfair at first glance, but then you realise that the entire point of money laundering includes the movement of criminal proceeds from where they're earned to stable and advanced economies. So the presence of a company in a higher risk country, even a fairly minor presence, could provide a money laundering conduit.
Indeed, Ray. And then next you mentioned where the company derived its income. So what countries is it selling goods and services to?
Yeah, or for that matter, what countries are in its supply chain?
And again, here you'd need to look at the highest risk jurisdictions involved.
Isn't that always going to mean high risk for any international business that might have one customer somewhere risky?
Well, it could do, I suppose, but normally you'd apply some minimum level of materiality.
Oh, okay. So, say countries that account for more than 5% of your revenue or 5% of your supplier spend.
Yes, and we've seen something like that in several banks. It means the bank can usually rely, particularly where it's a larger firm, on their audited reports and accounts, which should give that kind of picture.
And they'll want to update that view at review time in case the balance has shifted.
Yes, they will. The last point you mentioned, though, was ownership of the company.
Yes, Graham. Who owns the business and where they live or their nationalities are also relevant, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And here we do have a de minimis rule when you think about the UBO ownership thresholds.
Oh, yes, of course. So minor shareholders won't impact on the country risk. The bank won't even need to identify them unless they own more than 25% of the company.
Yes, or sometimes a lower figure, especially if there are other risk factors present.
Okay, well, I think that's pretty comprehensive, Graham. We've looked at how it works for individuals and then we've looked at how it looks for legal persons as well. I want to bring us back to what we said earlier, that country risk is only part of the client risk assessment. Let's go on to look at all of those other aspects next time, shall we?
Yeah, we certainly can't do them justice today, so let's pick them up then.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dark Money Files. We hope you enjoyed it. If you would like to listen to future episodes, please subscribe through iTunes, Spotify, or your normal podcast provider. Thanks.